The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. You can also leave a voicemail on the voicemail line, which is 206-337-5398, and that's recent. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hello, and welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 33. And yes, again, I have a guest. We've decided we're going to dissect the new Captain America, the Winter Soldier, and look at a couple of other upcoming things at the moment. And I have Robert Hood on the line. How are you, Rob?
I'm fine, thank you, Terry.
Great. Thanks very much for doing this, too, because it was very spur of the moment. We only organized this yesterday.
Yes, and came about because we were chatting on Facebook about Captain America.
Well, yeah, we're getting our geek on something big and went from there. So tell people a little bit about yourself, pimp your websites and anything else you've got going.
Well, I'm best known for writing short stories, a lot over the years, horror mainly, only not entirely horror, science fiction, anything spec fic, really. And like a lot of Australians, of course, I keep crossing over the genres and mixing them up, which is an interesting thing to do. There's a personal, my personal website is Robert Hood, one word, roberthood.net. And from there, you can pretty well get to all the other ones, which the most famous of which is Undead Backbrain, which basically discusses any new movies, old movies that relate to giant monsters, zombies and ghosts and stuff like that. There's a couple of other websites too.
Yeah, you're really big on the asylum type films as well.
Well, that was a passing fancy. They do a lot of giant monsters, so I ended up talking about them, and then they started sending me stuff.
Oh, nice.
Directly, well, it's sort of nice, except I got tired of the poor quality of most of them. I enjoyed some of the contacts I made. The director of Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus was a great guy, and the film, and I interviewed him and all that sort of stuff, which the interview can be found on Undead Backbrain. But that got that actually got the website and my YouTube channel an enormous number of hits, because Asylum gave me the trailer before anybody else, which you may recall had Giant Shark coming out and eating the Golden Gate Bridge and that sort of stuff, and I ended up getting millions of hits for that, and that was just a fluke. Anyway, Asylum sort of stuff. I do a lot of independent stuff, mainly because of a guy I know in America called Avery Guerra, who is really interested in this and is starting to make a bit of a career out of being publicist for some of the independent filmmakers.
Yeah, there's some really interesting stuff coming out there, and people are coming up through the grades as well from the independent stuff. I know James Gunn started out independent, and now he's doing Guardian of the Galaxy. Yeah. And the directors that they're talking around for Doctor Strange are very much people who came out of that background.
Oh, really? Mm. Yeah. I'd be interested to see who it is.
Yeah, they haven't announced anything yet. They haven't even announced who's going to play Doctor Strange, though there's any number of websites speculating about it. But, I definitely recommend Undead Backbrain. I'll dip into it now and then spend half an hour going through the previous postings and then realize I've spent half an hour.
Yeah, well, that's right. No, I haven't been. I used to post a lot, but discovered it was just, as you would probably know, it ends up eating up all your time. It's my primary function, and I was just not doing it, or rather any writing I was doing was these rather often quite research-heavy articles that I was writing for the site. But it just takes a long time, and so I had to cut back.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Podcasting can do the same thing. It can take up as much time as you want to give it, and you've really got to go, okay, I'm only going to do this on weekends, except in this case I'm going to do this because I'm going on holidays and things like that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And you get sucked into the podcaster world as well, which is not a bad thing. There's some fantastic people there.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But it uses up your time.
Yeah, it certainly does. People don't really realise it sometimes. I mean, I haven't done the podcast, but writing a simple article that might be based on a few screenshots that they send and maybe brief synopses and maybe a poster, that sounds like something you just throw up. But, yes, and I do that sometimes if I'm, you know, pressed for time, but mostly I have a tendency to then go into the background of the film and the ideas in the film and other films that led up to this one and what the influences were, and maybe even ending up having interviews with the directors and the like from the States. So it's, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds very, very familiar because I've got the two podcasts running back-to-back plus a weekly gig with ABC Local Radio in Darwin talking about classic films. Mm. So you've really got to schedule your time and go, okay, well, I want time for real life as well.
Well, that's right. I mean, I've had a full-time job up until recently. Cut back to 3 days a week just so I can get some writing done, because as I get older, and yes, I'm getting older, it got harder to write when I was coming home from a day of work. The whole time staring at a computer, because I'm a graphic designer in University of Wollongong, and just tiring. And all I felt like doing was basically sitting behind a bigger screen and watching movies or TV shows.
Yeah, I get that too, where I know I've got a commitment to do something for something, but all I really want to do is sit down with a really bad movie and a bowl of popcorn or something like that. So,
well, that's what eventually influenced my cutting right back. People used to send me stuff to review, which doesn't sound too hard, but you've got to watch it. Often they were not very good. Sometimes you find that gem amongst the whole lot that makes it worthwhile, but a lot of the time they're not very good. And so you try to find ways of actually talking about it that aren't insulting or depressing for the creators, because they mean well.
And they've spent a lot of time doing it too.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, just getting a feature film done, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, is a monumental task, even on a very low budget.
Yes, yes. And yet I've seen some absolutely marvellous things, you know, on a small budget, done by some guy on his Mac at home, you know, plus a bit of filming and help from friends.
Yeah, I remember the Sperrig brothers did Undead.
Yes.
And all of the special effects for that, which were quite impressive at the time, were done on a MacBook.
Yeah, that's right. And one guy I interviewed down in Melbourne during the Melbourne Film Festival was, what was his name? It slipped my mind, but the film that he'd made was The Horseman.
Yep.
You know that one? It's actually a revenge movie. His father takes revenge on the death of his daughter by hunting down all the criminals that were involved in involving her in pornographic videos and the drug scene. And when I saw the film, I was absolutely blown away. It was the most moving thing I'd seen all that year.
No, that's definitely on my list. It would have been Stephen Catrisius.
Yeah, something like that, yes.
Yep.
Which is why I can't remember his name.
Yeah, I had enough trouble with Nixtapopoulos' name for a couple of years.
Yeah, well, that's right. I've known Nick for many decades. And
yeah, I know. I've known him since I was living in Sydney, which is 22 years ago now.
Really? Yeah. So you lived in Sydney. Wow.
Yeah, once upon a time I did. I grew up in Sydney. In fact, I'm going back there over Easter.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so what have you been watching lately that was good?
Well, leaving TV shows aside, last night, Kat and I, that's Kat Sparks, we watched R.I.P.D. You've seen that one?
Yeah, it's pretty woeful in a way. It's
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, it was like they were trying to do Ghostbusters updated or something like that.
Well, they were. But
Men in Black, yeah.
I actually found it quite entertaining and find the not the criticism as such, but the extent of the criticism, a bit of an overkill. I mean, I found it quite entertaining, and I thought Jeff Bridges, he looked like he was really enjoying himself playing that bizarre character.
I was going to say Jeff Bridges was a saving grace for that film in a lot of ways. He played it in period, if you know what I mean.
Yes, well, that's right.
It's based on, and I did like him in there. I'm going to have to revisit it, I think. I saw it once under not ideal circumstances.
Even Kat quite enjoyed it, and she's much harder to please than I am.
Cool. I went retro with my watching. I watched Tremors the other day.
Tremors is one of my favourite monster films.
It's beautifully framed. The plot and the characterizations are great. They're perfect for what they need. They're not. The scientist is kind of like a secondary character in a way, but it's still got that beautiful. I mean, any science fiction monster movie set in a desert always has a big plus.
Yeah, well, that's right. It is actually beautifully written and beautifully constructed. And the saving grace of it, well, not this, you know, there's a lot of things that save it, so it's the wrong term. But the real strength of it is the characterization. You just like everybody that's in it.
Mm.
Yeah.
And Fred Ward, Fred Ward's one of those guys too that'll save any film he's in a sense.
That's right.
Yeah, and the bad thing I watched was Scary Movie 5.
No. I've only watched up to one.
that would be my ideal situation if I could have had a do-over on it to only see the first one. Number 5 is woefully bad. It's not even going to be bad enough to get a Razzie Award.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It was like that. But the other thing I did was I did a gig for the Darwin ABC radio thing, and we did The Bad Seed from 1956, which was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that is fun.
Yeah, serial killing 8-year-old girl. You gotta love that stuff.
Yeah, just very the actress, very scary. Really, does it extremely well. Yeah,
she's still acting too.
Is she?
Patty McCormick. Yeah, she. Her last.
Don't tell me. Something to do with a psychotic mother.
Mummy. Mummy 1 and Mummy 2. Yes. Not to be confused with the Stephen Sommers Mummy movies. But, so I haven't been watching too much else, really.
Well, I've got a list here. I'll just run through.
Run through what you
want. The other one we watched the night before was Ender's Game, which a lot of people, of course, boycotted because...
Did you pay for it?
Well, rented it down the local.
Okay, you can be forgiven if you rented
it. Yeah. Anyway, I quite like the movie. Know nothing about the book. Haven't read any of them. Thought it was okay. And the lead there was pretty good, too, although quite young.
Mm.
Yeah.
I was going to say that from the previews and the bits I've seen of it, it looked very much like a science fiction movie from 10 years ago.
Yeah, maybe sort of. I mean, I'm not keen on military training type films, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Which this was, at least in the first 2/3. But it got me in, and I was quite happy to go along with to see how it was all going to play out. I did guess the ending about, I don't know, a few minutes before it actually happened, maybe a bit more, but that didn't matter. And it's not – it doesn't strike me. I know the book's quite old. Like, I don't actually know when it was written.
80s, I think, late 80s.
Yeah, see, I'd swear that the actual concept behind the film goes back much further than that. In fact, there may even be a Star Trek episode that has a very similar premise. That is where the game becomes the actual battle.
Well, you could argue the War Games, which came out in about 82, had pretty much the same base premise. But as long as you're not giving too much money to Orson Scott Card, that's okay.
No. But, you know, if I start I had trouble with the whole thing. I know he's still alive and being an arsehole, but he's not actually doing anything illegal. And if you start making that judgment on him, where do you stop? Do you have to then explore the lives of every reader, every writer whose works you read, and get rid of all the ones who don't live up to it? I don't know. It's going to take out a lot of writers, I suspect.
And then it probably will, but I think you can cherry pick a little bit and cut down the ones that rear their ugly heads higher than the others.
Yeah. Anyway.
But I do take your point there with, you know, you can't really judge a lot of stuff based on the writer's lives. You can do it with musicians as well. I mean, I don't like Michael Jackson. I didn't like him before all this stuff came out about his proclivities.
Yes.
But I'm very intrigued by the denial aspect of that.
Mm.
The fact that there are a lot of people going, oh, I was never proved in court and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I guess Woody Allen falls into that one.
Yeah, I mean,
because I always admired him as a filmmaker and loved some of his films. And though he's been found innocent, a lot of people have been completely put off and are taking the stance of never watching anything by him again and mouthing off really violently against him.
We always need someone to hate. That's one of the things in society is you've always got to have somebody that that it's okay to detest.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's not a good side of human nature, but it's there. And I think the more that we know about people based on social media and the ubiquity of the internet and the loss of privacy we have in this century, the more we're going to see this kind of stuff about various people.
Yeah, I think so. Trouble is the internet isn't very discriminating. All it takes is for someone to say, oh, yeah, he did this, even if it's a complete lie or it's something that's ignoring factors that surround whatever it was that they were supposed to do.
Yeah, the Stephen Colbert thing. Yeah.
Instantly, and suddenly he or she is a pariah.
Yeah, it's so easy for it to happen, and it's one of those things where, I can jump on bandwagons with certain things as much as anybody, depending on my own prejudices and preferences, but I'm becoming increasingly aware over the last few years that there's got to be an end point to it. There's got to be a point where you say, no, I'm not going to be jump on this train.
Yes.
And I think I'm going to go individual basis on that one.
Yes.
Evaluate everything based on as much evidence as I can get if I care about it.
Yeah.
And then make my decision on where I stand with it.
Yeah. Sounds very wise. Can I just mention one other film?
Go ahead.
I had a bit of a longer list here that includes Hunger Games, Catching Fire, and Dead in Tombstone.
Have you said Dead? Don't know that one.
Oh, it's good old Danny Trejo.
Oh, cool.
Who's it's set in the West, and he is a part of a gang that are all killers and not very nice people, but his gang members betray him and kill him, and he goes to hell feeling very vengeful, and the devil says, well, look, I'll tell you what, just because I need people that get souls down here, I'll send you back, and you've got 20, I forget what it was now, but so let's say 24 hours to send all your the people that betrayed you, all your gang members, send them down here. So he goes up there. So it's what's that? What's the Clint Eastwood movie? Drifter.
Much more
violent and more exploitative.
Yeah, I always see Danny Trejo as kind of a reverse Schwarzenegger because he started his career at the same age Schwarzenegger's is tapering off. In a sense, he's 70 years old next birthday, and he's still appearing in machete movies with two topless women in a swimming pool.
Yeah.
You've got to love the guy for that, and the fact that he takes the piss out of himself beautifully.
Well, he does, and he really throws himself into the roles. The other aging actor that's in this is Mickey Rourke.
He doesn't look good these days.
No, well, he plays Satan in this, so that's okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think he's going to be stereotyped with roles like that because the things he's done to his face shouldn't be done to a brick wall.
Well, that's right. I have to say, you know, after he disappeared from the scene and then he came back with that boxing movie.
The Wrestler?
Oh, The Wrestler, yeah, The Wrestler movie.
Yeah,
and he was very good in it. And then he carried the whole thing. Anyway, other films are The Lords of Salem.
I did see The Lords of Salem, but I'm never impressed with Rob Zombie for some reason.
Yeah, well, I think Rob Zombie is something you like or you don't. I generally like him. I haven't watched all these movies because some of them are a bit along the lines of blood and gore for the sake of blood and gore, and I'm a bit sick of all that. But Lords of Salem, I was actually reasonably impressed with. It had a lot of style. I thought he directed well for atmosphere as much as anything else. And though it loses it at the end, and what it loses most, I thought, is one of its strengths was his wife, what Moon Zombie's performance.
Let's see. What is? I'm trying to think of her name. Sherry Moon Zombie or something.
Anyway, I thought she did a really good job, and sort of an unusual character too. As soon as she starts, it's about halfway through the film, she becomes more or less possessed by the witches and loses all character. And then the film sort of, for me anyway, went downhill to a rather lame ending.
Yeah, I'll agree with that part. And for me, one of the big issues is I totally dislike the music.
Oh, yeah.
That style of music is definitely not my bag, and it just takes me an extra step away from the movie.
Yeah, well, I understand that, but, you know, I went to a Rob Zombie concert recently, so.
Oh, fair enough, too.
Another film I wanted to mention, which isn't, strictly speaking, a genre film, but I was really impressed by it. Jane Eyre, the 2005 one.
Who's in that one?
It's Mia.
Wasikowska.
Yeah, her. Michael Fassbender.
Okay,
and
cool.
Judy Dench is in there too, playing a very haggard old governess, of course, or old lady. But it was a great version of the film, and it's extremely gothic. It brings out that period of writing with the Brontes and even Jane Austen had a stab at it at one stage, was influenced by the rise of the Gothic novel. And you can really see it in this.
Yeah, Monk Lewis and all those guys.
Yeah. And, that's right. And a lot of their sort of attitudes and techniques were taken up by the writers. And you can see it really being played for what it's worth here in the film. The director was Carrie Fukunaga.
Okay.
Who's actually been directing True Detective.
He directed all of that first season of True Detective.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay, I've just written that down because I'm definitely going to find a copy.
Yeah, no, it's excellent, provided you like that. I mean, it's costume drama, but it's gothic costume drama.
Well, the main movie we're talking about today is costume drama as well.
Well, yes, it is.
Yeah. Yeah, with our good friends. Just before we get into Captain America, though, the thing I really love about this and the wave I'm riding with the Marvel movies is the fact that they've created a whole new type of series in doing this.
Yeah.
I mean, they've got crossovers with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. They use social media fantastically well. They generate a buzz about even the smallest aspects of it, and it's a genuine buzz. It's not a bullshit buzz. People are genuinely interested in this. And they're doing a mosaic almost of movies where it doesn't matter if somebody like Robert Downey Jr. decides not to make any more of these. They've got everybody else there to fill the gaps.
Although he'll be a big loss when he decides.
I remember about 2008 when Iron Man was about to come out, and it was a bit of a surprise that they wanted to launch with a kind of second string Marvel character that not many people knew about at the time. Everybody knows Iron Man now, but it was only us diehard fans of Iron Man who go back to the Grant Ray 1960s TV series who really got off on the fact that they were going to make an Iron Man movie.
I guess so. It was always the Iron Man comics series were popular. But that's not enough. I mean, the real art of what they achieved was bringing it into the mainstream.
At the moment they've made something around $6 billion from these movies.
Well, that's right.
Which is fantastic.
Go on.
And it's not by dumbing them down.
No, it isn't.
It's by lifting everyone up to the level.
And they've just been really canny about doing it. I mean, the things that you were just expressing, the creation of the Marvel Universe, Cinematic Universe, as they're calling it now, of course, is really just replicating what they have always done in the comics. And I think they did it to a greater extent than DC did, even though DC would predate Marvel as such. But when I was much younger, just started uni probably, and a bit before that, I became absolutely obsessed with all, with Marvel in particular. I had a huge collection of a lot of this stuff in a cupboard that I carried around with me until I got sick of carrying it around with me and got rid of it. But the thing that attracted me to Marvel most is something that does annoy some people, but it was that you'd be reading Spider-Man and it'd cross over with, you know, Thor. And, okay, it means you have to go out and buy Thor if you weren't already buying Thor, but and so it's a great marketing thing, but I don't care about that. It was the fact that they were creating this thing that was bigger than any individual episode.
Absolutely, and Marvel kind of did that from the start, whereas DC, starting in the 40s, yeah. Batman lived in a separate universe from Superman and from the old Green Lantern and from the original Flash. It was only in the 50s that they started doing the crossovers, about 15 years after they started the comics.
Yes, that's right.
And Marvel hit that from the word go and decided to blend everything across.
Yeah. And the other thing Marvel always did too was really talk to their fans. The way the, you know, letter columns and things and all that sort of stuff were handled is very similar to the way everything's being handled now in terms of this film franchise. And just achieving what they have achieved. I mean, did anyone imagine that someone would succeed in making a series of films that interweave with each other that cost millions of dollars each? Huge risks involved all over the place, particularly at the beginning. Less risk now because they've created the groundwork on which all this is growing. But certainly at the beginning, it was just. But of course, that only happened when Marvel took over themselves.
Yeah, I think they had the innate love of it, and Kevin Feige taking over things.
Yeah, yeah.
Really, they had to basically get an incredibly competent fanboy.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Feige was, and he knows things like he's been talking for 4 years about getting Doctor Strange. And only now in Captain America, the Winter Soldier, and by the way, we are going to do spoilers in this. People, don't listen to the rest of the podcast unless you've seen the film and care about it.
Major spoilers, I suspect.
There will. And name-checking Stephen Strange in Captain America was my best squee of the whole movie.
I bet. I did the same thing. Anyway,
Because I'm on the Hollywood Stock Exchange, which is like a fake stock exchange for movies,
right,
where you buy and sell shares in movies. Mm-hmm. And I've been holding on to those Doctor Strange shares for 2 years now, and I'm just waiting for them to peak.
Well, hopefully they'll be as canny in the production of that as they have been in everything else. I mean, you're right about choosing who does these things. They've been all the way along. They've been good at casting. They've been even against expectation of people. I mean, I remember the discussion that went around when Robert Downey Jr. was cast as Tony Stark, and no one really, not no one, but a lot of people were very sceptical about that. And of course, he just spent years in jail.
He was a punchline at the time.
Yeah, that's right. But he really embraced that role, and he made it. I mean, he really did. It's hard to imagine Iron Man as anyone except him now, which is why it'll be difficult a bit down the road a bit.
I agree. And the other thing I found really interesting, and the one that really cemented it for me, was getting Mark Ruffalo to play to play Bruce Banner.
Pity they hadn't grabbed him for the earlier movie. But, I mean, I didn't hate the earlier movie, mind you. I thought it was quite good.
I like the Ann Lee as
well. Yeah, I like that too, but it's not in the same universe, so I knew why they had to. I mean, it doesn't look the same. It doesn't feel the same. It's a completely different feel. It was much more left field. And, yeah, it didn't really fit. So I wasn't surprised when I was a bit surprised when they did it at first. But as soon as the other films started to come out, I thought, oh, yeah, this is why they had to do it.
I mean, these guys are the biggest franchise in the world at the moment. Mm. They're, they're eclipsing James Bond because you've just got one guy at a time doing James Bond, whereas you can pump out anywhere. They're planning to pump out anywhere up to 4 movies a year with this.
Yes, so I think they've gone up to 5 in the latest thing I hear.
Yeah, but no, I'm there. My bum's on the
seat. Oh, yeah, they get money off me, no question.
Absolutely. So
what's saying the... hello. Say hello, Nemo. I'll have to put him down.
Okay, fair.
It's all right, he's gone.
Yeah. But getting back, probably should get back to Captain America now.
Most of the intelligence community doesn't believe he exists. The ones that do call him the Winter Soldier. He's a ghost. You'll never find him.
I joined S.H.I.E.L.D. to protect people.
Captain,
to build a better world, sometimes means tearing the old one down.
And that makes enemies.
Fast. Strong. Out of metal arm.
Are you ready? All it takes is one step.
People are gonna die. I can't let that happen.
Captain America needs my help.
When do we start?
We just did.
The price of freedom is high. And it's a price I'm willing to pay.
You told me not to trust anyone. This is how it ends. Everything goes.
Looks like you're giving the orders now, Captain.
Damn right.
How do we know the good guys from the bad guys? If they're shooting at you, they're bad.
First one I enjoyed a lot, and again they got in good actors, people like Stanley Tucci even for a little bit in there, and Hugo Weaving, who is kind of past his use by date as a villain now, because he's been in so many things, of course, The Matrix and all that kind of stuff. But
he does chew the scenery quite well.
He does, and he can do kind of weird accents, which is always a good thing with these kind of films. But, I mean, the big thing I take away from the Captain America thing, and which continues in the second film as well, is the beautiful use of diesel punk.
Yes.
Yeah, the kind of 1940s technology, just a bit futuristic for the 1940s that they had at the World's Fair scenes and also in Dr. Erskine's lab. Well,
that's right.
It's beautifully wonderful set design.
Yeah, when they started with that big gun that they were shooting that disintegrates everybody, that's... The design of that fits into what you're saying.
Yep, and then they continue it on in the 1970s technology that appears in Captain America, the Winter Soldier. I mean, I would have loved to have had that computer system because I reckon I could just almost get a podcast out with it.
Yes.
With the great big reels, great big magnetic reels and the really shit CRT monitors in green screen. Basically it all starts out with Captain America, part of the strike team for S.H.I.E.L.D., which is an interesting choice for them to make him part of that kind of surgical strike team that S.H.I.E.L.D. had to find out various things. And a S.H.I.E.L.D. ship's been taken over and they drop in there and suddenly you've got Batroc the Leaper in there.
Yes.
Which is kind of cool.
Most people wouldn't have a clue who that is, but that pricked my attention too.
Yeah, Batroc the Leaper, he'd have to date back to the 60s, or if not early 70s.
I really don't know his history all that well. No.
Yeah, I remember seeing him in a few things, and he had a kind of mask and a spade beard and great big mustaches. He looked almost like a proto-hipster.
Yeah, it was... he looked like a... a Parisian mine gone crazy. That's what.
Yeah, and of course, Sabat was his thing. Kickboxing, almost the French style of kickboxing, and in the movie, that is conveyed really interestingly. I love that framing of having them between the two lots of cabins on the deck of the ship, and having that big wide space that they fill the whole screen with for Captain America with his shield to fight Batroc in. It's a really interesting and it's a good choice of location for that kind of a fight.
Yeah, yes it was. I was quite impressed by the fights in that. They were varied and with, as you say, well-chosen places. Of course, I suppose the one people will remember most is the fight in the elevator.
Yeah, which works well, and they, I mean, even though it was an enclosed space, and what, they have about 12 people in the elevator.
Could hardly move.
but they used the space well, and the camera angles were well thought out. Obviously, the fight coordinators knew their stuff.
Yeah.
And there's a bit with the magnetic handcuff, which made it, it came out of left field and made it even more interesting and handicapped Captain America.
Yeah. They've been very clever about what they do. Yes.
Mm. And then you've got the big reveal in the movie about S.H.I.E.L.D. being two organisations.
Yes. I must say I wasn't really expecting that one, even though the other major reveal was I knew all about because I've read the Winter Soldier comic.
Yeah, the fact that the Winter Soldier was Bucky Barnes.
Exactly. Yeah. But Kat didn't know that.
Okay.
And she got that before the reveal.
Mm.
Mainly because they did that little reminder right at the beginning of who Bucky was.
Yeah, they did the refresher.
Yeah.
I suppose you've got to do that to a certain extent because you're going to lose a certain part of the audience.
It was real obvious that it was there, and it was enough for anyone who saw the first movie, because really Bucky wasn't in the first movie all that long.
But he's crucial to the development of Steve Rogers as a character.
Yes, very much so.
The fact that, you know, he's physically, before Captain America became Captain America, he was physically larger, and they kind of had each other's backs.
Yes.
So the relationship was established even before this movie came out, which made it really work. But I didn't know about the Hydra thing, that half of S.H.I.E.L.D. is actually Hydra. Yeah. But there were hints in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. that something big was going down and that S.H.I.E.L.D. wasn't quite the organization that the first few Marvel movies made it out to be.
Yes. Yes, well, of course, they've done that. Marvel's done that in the comics before, where they've made government agencies. Sometimes the American government itself has been infiltrated by, well, Hydra, among others. And so it's not as though it's unknown, but I just wasn't thinking about it in this instance. And I have to admit, I haven't seen Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. yet. We have this very bad habit, or good habit, whatever it is, of only watching TV shows that we want to watch when they come out on DVD.
Yeah, I think you're going to enjoy the first season because you'll be able to see it in retrospect where they talk about Centipede as one organisation and the Clairvoyant being one of the villains in it.
Yeah.
Knowing what you know is actually going to make the series work better than it did for us who waded through it going, what the fuck's going on here?
That's interesting.
Mm. But they knew right from the start of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., before the thing was made, what the plot was going to be for Captain America Winter Soldier. And they built Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. around that plot, which is the first time it's ever happened for anything in TV.
Well, I guess. And that's the other, when I read about this the other day, I just thought, that's amazing. I mean, they're spreading out in all directions. I'm sure that hasn't been done. I tried to think of examples where there'd been crossovers with TV shows, as distinct from just making a movie that's basically another episode of the TV show.
Yeah, I think that TV and movies, people tend to view them on their home screen, so I think the definitions are blurring. Yeah. People download movies, they download TV shows.
Absolutely.
Just the delivery system isn't as important as the content these days.
Yeah.
Which is why Channel 10, for instance, here in Australia isn't doing very well. They just haven't learned the lessons of the 21st century.
Mm.
But, yeah, I mean, the acting, I think Chris Evans is better in this one as Captain America than he was in the first one.
He's more comfortable in it, but then it's the lack of comfort sort of goes well in the first one because he's new to it.
Yeah, and he's not assertive either because he lets them do the USO tour thing.
Mm.
And it's only when it gets to a certain point that he stands up on his own two feet and takes action on his own behalf.
That's right, and that's the whole point. He had to get to that point where he stopped being a
puppet.
A dancing girl, as I think he's called at one stage, and becomes what he was meant to be.
Yeah, and I think it works well. I think Scarlett Johansson is warmer in this film as the Black Widow.
Yeah, the character's more complex, even though we still don't know much about her. But I think they're starting to feed little hints in to keep everyone going. And I was quite impressed by the way they handled it. Apart from anything else, the fact she didn't have makeup.
Yeah, because you don't tend to put on your lippy before you go into an operation.
No. But that's never stopped movie makers in the past. And it's just good to see that Marvel, or the people that Marvel give the job to, being much more cluey about all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I'm incredibly impressed with the way they do everything. They just really do. It's not necessarily micromanagement, but it's managing the big picture.
Yeah.
And I mean, things like when the first Guardians of the Galaxy trailer came out, I linked to it on Facebook. And because James Gunn and I have been Facebook friends for like 5 years before he became famous, the first person to like the fact that I linked to it and said James Gunn did a fantastic thing on there was James Gunn himself.
Yeah, that's great.
Oh, believe me, I got my total fanboy grin on for
it. Yeah, that's right.
Hours, and the fact that he admitted on his Facebook page, he wasn't sure how fans would react to it or people are going to react to the movie. It's still an unknown because it's a big change to the Marvel Universe.
Well, it is. It's another side of the Marvel. It's a big change to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and if it's popular, it opens up a pretty gigantic area of possible films.
Oh, very much so.
And cosmic stuff.
Which they kind of hinted at in the Avengers by having the Chitauri in there and all of the Thanos thing and that kind of stuff. But I think they've got enough goodwill now that they can make that expansion.
Yeah. Do you think they're going to integrate Guardians of the Galaxy with the other films through the medium of the Infinity Gems?
I think there is an overarching plot there because the bit at the end of Captain America, of course, has got Loki's staff in it.
Yes.
And there's a strong hint that the gem in Loki's staff is one of the Infinity Gems.
Yes, that's right.
Which raises the question, of course, is why didn't anybody pick up on that when they were putting the cosmic cube back to Asgard?
Mm.
But, I think that there are plots within plots within plots with Marvel.
Yes.
In the cinematic universe, and it's fine because you know you can whichever loose end you tug at, there's something interesting on the end of the line.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Well,
and I'm looking forward to Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can bring in Thanos and God knows what through all that, and of course there's a connection. Thanos is going to turn up, isn't he?
Well, inevitably.
The Avengers.
Yeah, and. In Guardians of the Galaxy, I mean, I read the first comics when they came out for Star-Lord, which were done late 70s, I think, late 70s, if not early 80s. So I've got an emotional investment in that stuff myself already.
Yeah.
I'm not as fond of the new Guardians of the Galaxy as I was of the older ones, but it's grown on me. I got the graphic novel of the new Guardians of the Galaxy for Christmas.
Right, yeah.
And I thought, yeah, I can see how this can work because it really kind of made the characters gel for me a lot more than they had in the past.
I hadn't read a lot of them, so I haven't actually read the new ones yet. I've got them on my iPad, actually. I do a lot of it electronically, although I've got bucket loads of the graphic novel book formats over there. You can't play the whole lot. I haven't read it yet because I went back and I've been reading a lot of the build up through the Annihilation Wars and all that.
Yeah, I've got the Winter Soldier comics on my iPad, and I'm kind of slowly working my way through them. I got sucked up in Captain America Reborn, so I haven't read them yet.
Yeah, I've read those. So I've read that whole sequence from right through the Civil War and Planet Hulk and all that stuff.
And I believe that Netflix are doing some TV stuff as well for the Marvel Universe with people like Luke Cage in them.
Mm. Yes, I've read that somewhere too. Yeah.
So that'll be interesting to see as well. Kind of, they've got ABC who's got Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Mm. They're going to have Netflix's new a streaming service, which is going to have a whole bunch of Marvel things as well, and they'll have the movies. So they're hitting every platform they can to provide content, all of which will interlink.
Yes, that's right.
Which is incredibly cool stuff, and I think it's something you can only do in this century. You couldn't do it previously.
No, well, it's all the different media and the interconnectability of all those things.
Yeah, and the fact that you can alert people on Twitter and Facebook and other platforms really quickly about changes and upcoming things. I mean, the three new images from Guardians of the Galaxy got released, and on my Facebook feed, there must have been 8 or 10 people who linked to them.
So,
I mean, we're not only the consumer of the product, we're also the delivery system.
Yes, and there's that too, Yeah.
So, overall, with Captain America, the thing I took away from it most of all was the fact that they're brave enough to throw out things like S.H.I.E.L.D. being good guys.
Yes.
They're willing to do that too, because it's not about protecting the babies. It's about telling a bloody good story.
Yes. Yeah. And they're quite willing for it to be a separate universe. I mean, they've done it before, even within the comics. You know, they go off at a tangent. So they're carrying that over into the movies very wisely, because with that Captain America, I could see elements of several of their storylines, including the Civil War sequence.
Yeah, absolutely. And given the way the world's going, where intelligence agencies are increasingly under scrutiny because of whistleblowers and because information will be free eventually, I think that having an intelligence agency that's only goody-goody isn't going to work. I mean, you can even see the changes in the James Bond series, where you've got that moral ambiguity about what they do with the way Silver was treated by the British Secret Service in Skyfall. So that ambiguity actually doesn't... I mean, you can't do your patriotic flag waving anymore, but the ambiguity of intelligence work of itself is really something that works strongly in favour of the story.
Yes. But this is one of the things I've always admired about Marvel, and I think Captain America lends itself to it, and that is the questioning of a lot of the assumptions of our society.
Yeah, and...
You know, when he's done, sure, it sells things, but there's a certain honesty about it too. Like when Watergate happened and Captain America felt that he didn't want to be the emblem of this government anymore, because its actions were not true to the ideals on which America was supposedly founded. So he quits as Captain America and becomes the Nomad. And Civil War is one of the most complex discussions, I think, of the whole abuse of power and responsibility and authority and who can you trust and all that sort of thing, because I'm good enough to say the government says we should do that. But what the consequences if you say the government says we should do that, but I'm not going to because it's immoral?
Yeah,
and these are questions that are just coming up all the time now in real life.
Yeah, I agree. And the thing that thinking people need to do is don't just automatically knee-jerk against things, evaluate them. Because I know there's a lot of stuff. I mean, the Abbott government, of course, is a nightmare for a lot of us. Here in Australia. But each time they do something, the thing I've been trying to do now is evaluate what they're saying about that they're going to do. Because they're not wholly 100% stupid. There's always a little... You can see what they're shooting for, even if they're doing it cack-handedly and dumbly.
Yeah. Well, sometimes I can't.
Well, yeah, there are some things that you can kind of look at and go, okay, I can see where they're coming from. Yeah. And there are other ones where you go, what the fuck, particularly bringing back knighthoods.
Weird on every level, anyway.
It is, and I think one of the advantages Australians have got, and one of the reasons why we respond to things like the moral complexity of Captain America, and that is we've got a national distrust of authority.
Yeah.
Right from the word go, it's part of the national culture to think the governments are up themselves.
Well, that's right. See, I wouldn't characterize American society as having that same sort of approach. And yet, when about it, it's sort of based on rebellion too. They had their civil war, didn't they?
Yeah, but I think that the years when government and big business controlled the media, which they don't tend to do as much now, have had a larger and more profound influence on America than on Australia.
Yeah.
But and the nice thing is that we're getting all of this complexity and this moral complexity in a pop culture movie, in an action flick.
Yeah, that's right.
Which shows how many different levels there are to these movies,
yes.
And the fact that they're so much more nuanced than
yes.
the DC movies are.
Yeah. And that whole discussion that Steve has with Nick Fury when he's first explaining the Shield's plan with these mega weapons that are able to interfere before something happens. That was an excellent piece of dialogue that reasonably subtly brought in the whole theme that runs through the movie.
Yeah, and it kind of felt a little bit like Person of Interest.
Mm.
The fact that the ubiquitous surveillance
yes.
and stopping things from happening.
Yes.
It's an ideal, but I haven't... And I mean, the intelligence agencies tell us all the time that they've stopped so many different plots and so many different things.
Mm.
But without the evidence,
yes.
Which of course can compromise security in itself by giving the evidence, without us knowing what they are,
yeah.
they expect us to believe them.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that anybody's bullshitting,
no.
but we do live in an evidence-based world.
Well, that's right. And in many ways, we're caught in a dilemma between the two.
Mm. Yeah, how much do you believe to be safe
yeah.
and how much do you distrust
yeah.
to be free?
Yeah, that's right. And this is one of the reasons why I reacted so strongly to, again, the Civil War sequence. As for those that don't know, they try to have the government legislate for superhero
registration. Yeah. Yeah.
Which causes all sorts of divisions in the superhero community, and suddenly friends are fighting friends. But it's really stark against Captain America. And surprisingly, but not surprisingly, Captain America is on the rebel side.
Mm.
He won't support the government in this because to him it seems like a violation of everything that they've claimed to stand for so long. But both sides make a strong argument for it.
Yeah.
I read the whole, it's a very complex and long sequence, and I was reading part of it and saying, yeah, Stark's right, he's doing this, but no, it has all these consequences, so how far do you go? And it just went backwards and forwards through the whole thing, and of course doesn't resolve particularly well at the end. I mean, it does from
yeah,
a literary
it's messy.
View it does, but the whole thing is a mess. And
all
goes to pieces, though it leaves its scars that are still in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing for me. I make parallels between Captain America and Mel Brooks.
Mm.
Now, bear with me on
okay,
this.
Okay, I'm waiting.
Okay, Captain America fought for freedom during World War II and subsequently.
Yeah.
So it gave him a certain right to stand up and say talk against authoritarianism.
Yeah.
When it appeared in his own government. Mel Brooks was a bomb disposal expert in World War II. You there?
I'm there.
He has every right to make a movie taking the piss out of Hitler.
Yeah.
You see, he's got that moral authority from having actually done stuff about it.
I see, yeah. Okay.
See what I mean? Okay. And a lot of people going, oh, yeah, making comedies about Hitler is bad and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Hitler tried to kill Mel Brooks. I think all bets are off when that happens.
Yeah.
So Captain America, to me, has the same kind of moral authority to fight fascism and authoritarianism because he's done the hard yards.
Yes. Quite right. But, of course, in the Mel Brooks instance, the fact is Mel Brooks was actually taking the piss out of Hitler by doing it. He's hardly supporting him.
Yeah, absolutely. And Mel Brooks had every right to to do that. But people were going, oh, no, it's too soon. You can't make jokes about Hitler in the 1960s and it's bad taste comedy and all this kind of stuff. But no, Mel Brooks had the right.
Yeah
so there you go. Not many people are going to make an analogy between Mel Brooks and Captain America.
Right. Well done. You get high points for analogy making.
Thank you very much. Okay, we probably should move on to your other fave. You're a big kaiju guy, aren't you?
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, the anthologies, you can tout them if there are any of them around.
Well, the first one, which was arguably the best, is out of print. It's gone through a reprint once. But it's not completely out of print because thanks to the wonders of modern technology, you can buy it from Amazon.
Okay.
PAD, and it's lovely too because it meant I didn't when we initially produced it, it was soft cover only. But of course, once it went to Pod, we were able to do it as a hardcover. So I got to have a hardcover of this book myself. I bought it. I bought one.
Whoa!
Yeah.
Tell people what the book is.
It's called Daikaiju! Giant Monster Tales, and that was followed by two sequels. Simply because when I did the first one, Robin Penn and I discussed it with Robin Penn for nefarious reasons of my own because we'd always talked about these matters ourselves, even though he lives on the other side of the country in Perth. And I felt that I wanted to have another editor who knew about this stuff to help me evaluate the stories I wasn't sure about. I talked to Robin about this and we said, yeah, okay, let's do this because nobody had at that stage. And so I made an announcement on the web and it just went crazy. And we ended up getting hundreds of stories from around the world. I made a fundamental mistake and that was I opened it up really for a year or so, nearly a year, for submissions, which just meant they was hard to get back to people early because you would want to hang on to stories, but you wanted to have the right to not keep it if something better came up later. it's hard. And I had quite a range of people submitting. Some were very experienced writers who were also fans of the genre, and right down to people that had never written a story before. And at least one of those got in. I won't say which one it was in the book, but there was at least one in which the person had, though he'd written things, it was all on a fan level, and the story was very faulty, but I really liked it, and I thought it had something there, so I just worked with him to get it working in a way that could be felt to be more professional. And that's been one of the more popular stories in the collection. Anyway, ended up with a lot of more stories than I could possibly put into one volume. And so when it did so well, I decided to do a second volume. Couldn't afford to do it. When I say well, I don't mind financially well, but just, we moved a reasonable amount of copies and got a lot of positive response. And I couldn't afford to actually do physical versions again. This was pre-pod at the time, so we decided to just do it electronic. And but once we did that, there was a Gold Press. Once we decided to do that, the opportunity came up to link up with Prime Books in the US. And so we did for all three of the books, I ended up doing a physical version of each of the two following books, following on from the first one. And and then it went up as PAD through Prime. And, they're selling, I assume. We get a small check every now and again. Which is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
Never enough to pay back the authors, which is sort of sad. But anyway. That was a really good experience, but I tell you, it took up about a year and a half of my life where I hardly wrote a thing of my own, except a giant monster story that I actually wanted to put in the first volume but decided that it was just not cool for an editor to put his own story in, even though I sent it to Robin under a pseudonym.
Okay, and Robin...
He said, yeah, let's put this one in, but I still took it out. But then I put it in the last book, as the last story in the last book.
I think you're entitled.
Yes, and apart from anything else, it's sort of in the story, I attempt to get to the basis of what is of what these giant monsters stand for in a metaphorical sense by starting off with the Godzilla type created by atomic weapons, atomic tests part of it, right through to assuming that that was the great fear that produced it. And, of course, it came just after Hiroshima and Nagasaki were bombed. And that's definitely, particularly if you watch the Japanese version, right, and the American...
Yeah, the original version.
The original version is quite strong, and you can see what it is actually all about. But working on that as the great fear of that time, what giant monsters might different periods have produced? So I sort of came up with an industrial revolution monster and right up to a digital environment monster.
Oh, cool.
So in a way, my story encapsulated everything that the book was originally created for in the first place. So I thought it was valid to put there as a sort of afterword from me. Anyway,
So your interests basically would have come about from things like the American Godzilla when you're a kid and Beast from 20,000 Fathoms and all those kind of things, and then into the Japanese ones.
I never saw Godzilla.
Okay.
Godzilla King of the Monsters. That's the American version of the Japanese one. Never saw it. Not that long ago. And then SBS showed the original Japanese one.
Mm.
And I saw it because I'd wanted to see it for years. But, you know, I date from an age where you couldn't just see anything you want because it wasn't necessarily available.
Yeah, you had to wait years to see Creature from the Black Lagoon on television.
Exactly. So, yeah, when I saw that, I thought, yeah, this is it. Then I got obsessed with Godzilla and started to track down all the Japanese with subtitle versions, of which few were commercially produced. So I ended up in desperation getting them from some fan who had done his own dubbing, very good dubbing, I might add, of these films and selling them online.
That would have been VHS days, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it was originally, but then went to DVD. And most of his were on DVD by then. But as all those films have become available commercially, I have done the right thing and actually paid for genuine copies.
Yeah, I tend to do that. I tend to backfill. I watch them on dodgy downloads.
Yes.
And then if the quality's up there and I've got the money, I'll backfill and get them all. And then I'll go, okay, well, what am I going to do with this one I burned onto a CD, onto a DVD? But, I think quality does show out even if people are pirating.
Yeah, well, that's right. But you know, having said that, there's at least one. I can't think of another one. There's at least one of the original Godzilla films that still hasn't been available.
Which one?
Godzilla versus King Kong, or King Kong versus Godzilla.
Okay.
Yeah, the American version is available, but it is an atrocity. It's a great fan. People sort of love it, but they love it because they can poke fun at it.
Mm.
And it's very bad. And yet it's filmed by Ishiro Honda. It was directed by Ishiro Honda, who directed the first film.
Yeah.
And many other great films. And
Human Vapor, for instance.
Yes, yes.
I love his Human Vapor.
Yes, a good one. And he was often the second director for Kurosawa. And they were great friends. Kurosawa used to say that Honda was one of the best directors in the country. This is coming from a man who was arguably one of the best directors ever.
Absolutely. I did Seven Samurai on a podcast a while back, and rewatching it just blew me away.
Yeah, he's terrific. I love his other stuff. I'm a big fan of his noir stuff too, noir crime stuff.
I'm going to have to look into
that. Very interesting. Yeah, you should. Some really good stuff. Anyway, so the original version of King Kong was also the movie out of all the 25, 26 Godzilla movies that had the biggest box office take in Japan. Okay. It was gigantic. And I thought, why? It's such an awful film going on, this one that the Americans produced. Boring and terrible, laughable costumes, etc. And then I got from that fan that was doing his own, I actually got one. And I was just blown away at how different it was, totally different. The American edit is a complete insult. It's almost a racial slur.
Some of them tended to go a little that way.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll just give you an example of how far off beam they went when I watched it. The American one starts with a really dodgy globe of Earth spinning in space with this bad voiceover talking about how fragile life on Earth is and a little change can make it, the world stop, and the world stops and you hear all these people screaming and all this. And then it cuts to an American newsreader who spends the next half hour talking about a whole lot of boring shit that has nothing to do with anything in the film. And so everyone laughed at it and say, look at those bad special effects and, oh, that terrible stuff, you know, the terrible dialogue there, and the Japanese, oh, aren't they funny? Then you see the real one, and guess what? The film's still funny, but it's funny because it's meant to be funny. In fact, most of the actors, many of whom disappear completely from the American version, were famous comedians of the day in Japan. Comic actors, rather, comedians. And the film starts again with this wobbly globe of the Earth.
Yep.
It's going around, and there's a bit of narration that's pretty dumb in itself. And then halfway through it, suddenly a voice says, what is this? And the camera pulls back, and there's this guy lounging back looking at it on a TV and saying, did we put money into this? Why did we put money into this? This is awful. And so it goes on. Yeah.
Okay.
So the Americans treated a lot of footage that was meant to be stupid as something that was meant to be serious, which made it laughable for the wrong reasons. A lot of that happens right through the film.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff they took out of the original Godzilla as well, all those things of people worrying about whether they're going to have to go into shelters again and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that scene where the people come out of the house in the village and the house gets crushed behind them.
Lots of stuff like that. In fact, any reference to the bombings were removed.
Yeah, and then they put Raymond Burr in there playing Steve Martin.
They did.
Which is even funnier now than it was when it came out.
Yes. I have to say, I mean, Godzilla King of the Monsters, even though they took those things out, they actually did it reasonably carefully. I don't find it insulting. It just made it made what is arguably an A-grade important classic film and turned it into a B-grade monster film.
I'd go along with that, yeah.
But King Kong versus Godzilla, that was an insult, and so were some of the others. So anyway, I became obsessed with actually tracking down these versions and finally got them, and that started the whole thing, and then I progressed to other giant monster movies, and it just goes on endlessly, particularly now that they seem to have caught on again and are no doubt set to have another big spurt after the new American Godzilla film comes.
Which looks like they might do it right this time from what I've seen on the trailers.
And I just heard that apparently Toho has seen the film and they love it.
Cool.
They saw the 1996, was it, one?
98.
They saw the 1998 one and hated it.
I don't blame them. Even Jean Reno couldn't save that movie.
I still remember where they had one of the Godzilla directors at the premiere of that, the 1998 film, and as they were coming out of the theatre, a news person came up with a microphone, shoved in front of him, and said, "So, what did you think? What did you think of that Godzilla?" And he just says coldly, "That was not Godzilla," and keeps walking. It's such contempt.
Not the PR they wanted.
No.
But this one, I mean, you got Bryan Cranston in there, who's got the one of the best arcs as an actor you've ever seen in your life. Apparently, he was in an episode of Babylon 5.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he turns up, does a little brief bit in an episode of Babylon 5. That's how kind of low rent he was for a long time as an actor. Did Malcolm in the Middle and then went on to do Breaking Bad and just blew everyone away.
That's the thing that did it. Very popular. I have to confess, I've never seen it.
I've seen the first season, but I was kind of in a headspace where I wanted to steer away from dark and ugly people who were fucking up their lives.
Yes, I know how you feel about that. It's like... Kat and I have this regime for watching TV shows. We tend to watch a fantasy-based one. At the moment, it's Grimm.
Yep.
And then we watch a like crime or thriller type or dramatic show. At the moment, it's The Eagle, The Crime Odyssey. You know that one?
Yep.
From Denmark.
I've heard of it.
But before we got The Eagle, which isn't that heavy, so it can get that way. You know, we're watching stuff like Game of Thrones and all this. And as much as I think they do a great job in Game of Thrones and it's quite compelling, I was finding really depressing, as a lot of HBO shows are, because they're full of such nastiness and violence and whatnot, that we found we weren't sleeping very well, so we figured we needed to watch something light and fluffy before going to bed. So now we watch something light and fluffy. At the moment, it's Eureka.
Oh, yeah, why not?
Just full of nice people doing strange things with science.
Yeah, Game of Thrones is incredibly popular now, which is really funny to me because I took my first paperback edition of Game of Thrones to work. Yeah. And I kind of said to them, take a look at this. It was signed in 1997 by George. And I got so much street cred out of that.
Yeah,
this is before there was even thought of doing a TV series.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and people went, oh, okay. Yeah. So they were incredibly envious, and I had to put the book away in case someone nicked it.
Yes, they probably would have. Yes. So anyway, as you were saying, this Godzilla really looks like they're doing it right.
The size of the Godzilla seems to be bigger.
Garth Edwards won me just from Monsters, which he made on a shoestring, and it's a decent movie.
Yeah, and it's got there's a weird lyrical beauty to the monsters in Monsters. Yeah, which is kind of cool. And the one Godzilla story I've got that I really appreciated was I flew from LA to Tokyo once in 1998. And for a very long time, we were flying over the Japanese countryside, you know, the rice paddies and all that sort of stuff. Could well have been Fukushima for all I know. And it suddenly occurred to me that I was flying exactly at the same height as Godzilla's head.
Which Godzilla? Because this new one is bigger than it's ever been.
Well, yeah, this is 1998, so I'll go with traditional Godzilla. And I thought, I've got a Godzilla eye view of Japan. This is the coolest thing that's happened to me in a very long time. And it stayed there for about, it must have been 20 minutes we were coasting around, and it was at that height.
Yeah.
It was just crazy.
Yeah. The Japanese Godzilla in the 90s was fairly big. They made him bigger then. But buildings got bigger, you know. So to make a believable Tokyo, they had to have bigger buildings, but the bigger buildings made the original Godzilla look a bit small, so they just made him bigger.
Yeah, and I always thought that Godzilla would have learned eventually to kind of go around power lines.
Yeah, well, later he just walks through them and it doesn't matter because he's so big.
I mean, he can step over them now.
Yeah.
Do you know how tall this new Godzilla is? It seems enormously big.
Yeah, I've forgotten, but I'd read it somewhere. He's much bigger than anything that we've had before.
Yeah,
you can tell by the trailers.
Yeah, I don't understand the bit in the trailer where the guys are skydiving with the flares on.
No, I'm waiting to find out why they're doing that.
Because that would surely alert Godzilla that something's coming down.
Yeah. I wonder how much it's got to do with Godzilla. It's got to do with the other monsters that are in it. But we don't really know the storyline for those other monsters yet.
No, they do look a little bit interesting, but they're going to have to be a bit careful about how they do them because of Pacific Rim.
Yes.
I think, yeah, well, you don't want it to look too samey, a specific rim.
They don't. Anyway, they're also trying to obviously make them not look like any of the other Toho monsters. Because, as anyone that knows the Japanese Godzilla would know, he's got lots of monster buddies all over the place. They get into wrestling matches periodically.
Yeah, every now and then.
Japanese have an insatiable appetite for kaiju, for giant monsters. It's just amazing. Yeah. I mean, Godzilla's only the tip of the iceberg. The rest of the iceberg is Ultraman.
Yeah, and Hello Kitty.
Yes, but...
I think a Hello Kitty kaiju would be really fun.
Yeah, probably would be. But Ultraman amazes me. I mean, I got obsessed with Ultraman at one stage too, because it was begun back in the 60s, not as a spin-off, but, you know, it was made as a TV show, and it has a giant... superhero who comes from another galaxy and is channeled through a human pilot and becomes big to fight these giant monsters that randomly turn up on a regular basis. But that was the show that began back in the 60s, and it's never been out of production since.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff, and unless you've kind of got the background, it can be totally inexplicable when you watch an episode. Yeah.
And not only that, I mean, I made a whole argument about this in an article I wrote once, but it's pretty formulaic. So you watch it as, that's one word, we would say mostly formulaic, where, you know, monster turns up, fights monster with details along the way, gets rid of monster. They play with it. But that formula remains pretty consistent through this hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of episodes and quite a few movies as well. And I argued that it was a sort of ritual.
And it's reassuring too. It's probably like the stuff that you and Kat watch to chill out.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a reassuring nature to some of
these. I guess so, because it's, you know, kept its audience in Japan, whereas Godzilla didn't. And they stopped making Godzilla because the audiences were going down. The audiences were too entranced by... How big American films were getting, and so they were.
Yeah,
they were. Right from Jurassic Park was a big, huge hit in Japan,
which is 20 years old.
That's
now.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I've been watching a little bit of Japanese stuff lately. I dipped into old school Gigantor.
Oh yes, yes.
Yeah. So I've been watching some black and white episodes of that intermittently when I just want something a little bit chill out.
There's a really fun Gigantor live action.
I've seen it. Yeah, the Temujin 28.
Yeah.
I saw that, but I don't understand that remote control unit, because the kid has a joystick and an antenna there, and nothing he does ever relates to what Gigantor does.
No.
I think it's just there to reassure the kid.
That's because as Gigantor went along, the whole being controlled by the kid sort of changed.
Yeah, I think that it's there basically as a blankie for the kid.
Yeah, yeah.
That's my theory. But I am enjoying it now. I love that limited animation that they had because of budget limitations at the time and how they made it work.
Yeah.
Okay, so anything else we want to talk about? We're an hour and 18 minutes in, so we probably should wrap this thing up.
True.
Well, it might be an hour and 18 by the time.
Cat always implies that once you get me going, you can't stop me, which is...
We love that in podcasting.
There is a sort of truth, but yeah, I guess we're better, right?
Yep, so anything else you want to plug or advise people?
Well, I keep mentioning to people, we talked about Marvel a lot, and they're doing fantastic things in film, and DC seems to have dropped the ball. Yes, they have Batman, but... For such a popular franchise, they don't seem to be doing the right thing with it.
I'm going to wait and see the new one.
Sorry?
I'm going to wait and see how the new one goes.
We'll see how they go. But anyway, where they are doing Batman well, and they keep doing it, and their other superheroes, is in animation.
Absolutely.
I just love their animation. I've just watched a new one. I don't know whether you've seen it. I don't think it's had a release here, called Beware the Batman, Shadows of Gotham.
Haven't seen that one. I saw the Flashpoint Paradox with the Flash.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I recommend.
Yes.
But I'll have to do Shadows of Batman.
Yeah. Shadows of Gotham. Yeah. It's not a film. That one. It's a series. And yep. Only the first half of the series has come out at the moment, so it ends in a big dilemma. But it's really interesting, and the animation is quite different from any other Batman that we've had before. It's computer animated this time, which they explored with Green Lantern recently. It's a great success, okay. I thought.
Yeah, I thought the Green Lantern Corps stuff really worked, and they were trying to. It's really odd because at a certain stage, the characters in the animated ones became more complex than the characters in the DC live action
stuff. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I actually cared about that. What's her name? The robot. You know, the one that was the manifestation of the ship's AI.
I didn't watch that episode. I only watched a few of them so far.
She's in it a lot and becomes a major character, and things happen. And I cared.
Yeah, I mean, the Flashpoint Paradox impressed me too because it really got into Flash as a character.
Yeah.
And I kind of liked the way they did that. And given the fact that you basically just are doing it with a whole series of drawings shown one after the other,
yeah.
I think they've done incredibly well with it. So, yeah, DC's kind of – and DC hasn't integrated – that's the thing, they've gone animation.
Yeah.
Whereas Marvel's gone live action for their TV stuff.
Yes.
To a big extent, so they can integrate it with the movie stuff and enrich both of them.
Yes, yes.
Whereas DC's got to now reinvent everything.
Anyway,
Rob, thank you very much for this. I really, really appreciated it. It went fantastically well.
It's a pleasure.
I'd like to get you on in future if I could, sure. At some stage, and we'll have another long rambling chat that doesn't make any sense in a logical sequence but works in the end. are you going to be down for Continuum?
No.
Okay. Well, I won't catch up with you there. But anyway, thank you very much for that.
I'll get out at some point because I just heard recently that and I never knew this, that the Melbourne Art Gallery has one of the best collections of William Blake's paintings and drawings in the world. Now, I've seen his stuff at the Tate, but I didn't know we had any here. I think it's the Victorian, I think it's called the Victorian Art Gallery. And
National Gallery Victoria.
Yeah, probably. They're taking them all out of storage, and between now and August, they're showing them. So I'm going to have to jump on a plane and go there.
Give me a yell when you're on your way down. We'll have a meal.
Yeah, it might be good. Yep.
Okay. Well, take care, and thanks again for this, and it should be up probably tomorrow.
Okay.
Okay, thanks. Okay. Bye. Yeah.